Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's The Wonky Show. A review of the graduate route is coming just as international applications tick down. We'll discuss the implications. It's Ref 2029 now. We'll explain the delay. How many graduates does the UK need? It's all coming up.
What we need to do is to move from that supply side, look, everything's going to be fine if we just produce more of this stuff, to a really hard set of strategies and conversations about how do the things that we produce get deployed.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Associate Editor Jim Dickinson, and here for non-uniform day with their board games to play, as usual, three terrific guests. Justine Andrew is Head of Education and Head of the University Partnership Office at KPMG. Justine, your highlight of the week, please.
At KPMG in Leeds, we had the KPMG kick-off Christmas event where we had 200 people, we had children singing, we had Christmas trees, and we had a plethora of pork products. So what is not to like about that?
Very festive. And in Manchester, Andy Westwood is Professor of Government Practice at the University of Manchester. Andy, your highlight of the week, please.
Oh, well, I'm going to sneak in two, if that's all right, Jim. The first is sort of very much work-related, and it's a report that we managed to get out this week, Diane Coyle, Stella Erker and I, on universal basic infrastructure, which has taken us about 6 years to write. So we're very pleased to get it out. It's published through the Bennett Institute, so if anybody wants to go and look at it, hopefully they can find it and enjoy it. And the second highlight of the week, which I wanted to share, was that I'm just about to join the board of the University of Wolverhampton.
Oh, how exciting. Great stuff. And linked to the report, of course, in the show notes. And in Prestatyn, Michael Salmon is news editor at Wonky. Michael, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi, Jim. Yeah, it's been another, you know, equally high calibre week in Westminster. I think my just particular highlight was Gillian Keegan being asked at the Education Committee whether she was pro or against poisoning her own children, and she didn't answer. So, you know, we'll have to find out.
Well, there you go. So we start this week with international students. And Andy, it's been a week of downs and downs.
Downs and downs. Well, yet another week of headlines on migration figures and the government's response to them. It's a familiar kind of list of things for universities that are interested in these things. And that, of course, these days is all universities. We've got a series of announcements, really, from government. The first is a new package of measures to bring down migration. We talked about migration figures recently on the podcast, so it's not taken very long for the package to kind of bring those numbers down to emerge. The most significant one for universities is that the Migration Advisory Committee is going to be reviewing the graduate route, but there are also some quite significant measures around increasing salary thresholds for spouses on kind of regular visas, as well as kind of obviously the measures on spouses of people studying. Then we've had another Rwanda treaty, another visit of another Home Secretary to Rwanda to sign a treaty, and the presentation of legislation to the House on what Parliament can do to override essentially anyone's objections to Rwanda being seen as a safe country. So all sorts of stuff that the government have thrown together. In the midst of all of that, obviously the Immigration Minister, Robert Jenrick, has resigned. So we currently, at least as we're recording this, don't have an Immigration Minister. So some might say this has all been a bit knee-jerk, a bit of a political panic, a bit of political chaos, but with potentially very significant ramifications, not just in terms of the detail of these measures that are being proposed, but also just that wider culture, that wider environment, that wider debate about universities and the economy, and which matters more to the government, the headlines on migration or kind of building an economy that might, fingers crossed, actually work.
Having already banned overseas master's students from bringing family members to the UK, I have asked the Migration Advisory Committee to review the graduate route to prevent abuse, to protect the integrity and quality of the UK's outstanding higher education sector. It needs to work in the best interests of the UK, supporting the pathway into high-quality jobs for the global talent pool, but reducing opportunities for abuse. Madam Deputy Speaker, this package of measures, taken in addition with the measures on student dependence that we have already announced in May, means that around 300,000 fewer people will be eligible to come to the UK than were coming last year.
Well, Michael, as well as all of that, we've had some signals on international recruitment for January, haven't we?
So the recruitment platform Enrollee, I think over the weekend, published its own sort of predictions based on its really large sample of international students that it sort of has on its books. I think there's sort of more than 58,000. And it does this every quarter and has tended to be quite accurate in the past, or at least sort of be quite a good bellwether. And the predictions here were really, really negative for the January intake. There was words like collapse being thrown about, especially talking about the Nigerian market. And we've heard from elsewhere, there was something from study portals as well this week. And, you know, I think everybody who's watching that market is seeing that the January postgraduate intake there is going to be far lower than 2023, when admittedly it was very, very high. So there's the new dependent rules coming in. But I think even more than that, it's just about affordability. The economy there is not in a good shape. The sort of foreign exchange is much worse than it was a year ago. So it is looking like universities that have been doing a very good job, we could say, of diversifying into that market are going to really suffer. But Enrollee was also predicting Indian students to fall quite significantly as well, which obviously on the sort of macro scale is a more important market for the sector. So yeah, it could be quite a tough January ahead, which is, it's not like things have all been good up to here for the sector's finances.
Justine, I guess, on one level, some universities that didn't have a great summer will have been hoping that January made up some financial ground. That will be tough. And to another extent, in general, if these numbers suggest that international demand is, I think the word might be softening, these numbers that Michael talks about were before the signal gets sent about the graduate route. This puts a lot of universities in real financial difficulty, doesn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't. And it just compounds all of the existing conversations that I think we've been having across the sector, doesn't it, for the last, a couple of years, really. I mean, I think as you mentioned, Andy, it's that link, isn't it, between, it's a free market, so you want universities to be commercial and go where the demand is, which is exactly what, boards have been looking at. And in a true commercial market, you would have control over that. But of course, they're in the worst of both worlds because it's looking for those markets, but then you don't always have that control in terms of numbers, in terms of policy and the impact. The universities are working hard. They're looking at portfolios. They're looking at the core. But I think it's a really tricky line for boards to manage, right? Because what would you do? You'd say, well, of course, go where demand is, look at the opportunities. But you've also got to focus on that core. You've got to look at the core portfolio, the home market, the other areas that are going to build that resilience. But it's a very difficult line to manage because ultimately the funding model is not fit for purpose at the moment. And I don't know whether this would force that discussion next year, whether there is a quid pro quo in this that says actually this will force the conversation that the sector wants to have about the overall financial sustainability.
Andy, was this inevitable? I mean, one of the things I think I could argue is that if the sector does, many, many, many times better than it said it would on recruitment, and you add in dependence too, with this government, there was inevitably going to be a swing back on the pendulum, wasn't there?
Yeah, I think so. I think if you look at the two, well, probably the two most important things to the government at the moment, one is managing borders and the other is trying to get some growth into the economy. Now, unfortunately, those are related. They're not very convenient related when you kind of start to think about the politics, and particularly the politics of this government. And Suella Braverman and Robert Jenrick, to a lesser extent, has in some senses played a blinder, because she tried to get all this stuff through when she was Home Secretary, And the education department and the treasury played the economic card, said, you know, we need some of this stuff. International students are particularly valuable, and it was all pushed back. Now, this just might be explained by the fact that she was a terrible Home Secretary and can't do government delivery. But out of office, the government have completely kind of caved into her agenda. And worse than that, have kind of backed themselves into a corner on immigration as the totemic policy, even over kind of all of that sort of economic growth stuff, which is causing them all sorts of problems around cost of living, around regional inequality, around trade, stagnation. You know, they're going for this one because it's the one that suits their populist credentials and opens up the most significant dividing line with an election in the offing. But it's still a huge, huge gamble for them because, of course, there's no real kind of guarantee that any of these numbers, whether for illegal immigration or legal migration, are going to come down significantly ahead of an election. But that's where the politics is. And if that's where the politics is, that's where universities' management teams and universities' boards are going to have to be too.
Michael, obviously this is a conversation principally about international, but there were some really interesting numbers in the student loan company figures in terms of this year, in-year numbers, which showed home domiciled PGT down really quite significantly and home domiciled undergrad down significantly and down further than UCAS figures would have suggested. So there's something else going on here which will be worrying for folks in the home market too, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, so we've just had UCAS end of cycle data today. And as you said, we had SLC student support data out last week, which is about how much students are taking out loans. And as we spotted and sort of wrote about, the postgraduate master's loans are down, what is it, sort of 15% around, don't quote me on that, but it was a big sort of fall in the teens of, you know, a loan that perhaps people don't really sort of pay attention to so much, and, you know, which doesn't necessarily indicate falling postgraduate numbers of the same extent. There could be fewer students taking out loans, but, you know, there's definitely something going on there. It's something we've been seeing for a long time, that sort of home students in the wider sort of PGT landscape have become squeezed. You know, the numbers have increased, but the international proportions of PGT have just increased so much. You know, I mean, there's sort of talk you hear sometimes about whether home students see master's level study as sort of the same aspiration, whether, you know, those who are really serious about doing research and doing more study want to just go, you know, directly into PhD routes. That's obviously still quite a minority at the moment. But the postgraduate market has just gone haywire, really, in terms of who's on the courses, which providers teach them, which subject areas are, you know, what the staff students ratio is. I mean, it's not helped by the fact that, you know, all the regulatory attention in England and elsewhere really is on the undergraduate, you know, outcomes. There's a real sense that, you know, the sector's become very dependent on the money from postgraduate as a whole, but especially international postgraduate, and that necessity to recruit there is masking problems around, you know, delivery and quality and the sort of size and shape of the sector.
Justine, one of the things I often say is that I have this sense that higher education isn't really suited to very, very rapid expansion. And I guess by definition, I assume I also mean that higher education isn't really suited to very, very rapid contraction either in its student numbers or finances. Is there a kind of mismatch between the sort of governance that higher education has in general, either on quality or on, you know, infrastructure and whatever, and the kind of drama that we're seeing in the sorts of numbers that we've had over the past couple of years?
Well, it's a perennial debate, isn't it? And the sort of size and shape. If you were starting from a blank sheet of paper, would you design a university governance structure as it is at the moment? No. But is it, you know, we are starting from where we are at the moment in terms of those structures, and people are adapting, are trying, but the infrastructure that sits there is very hard to change, right? You've got a huge estate cost, you've got a huge people cost, and lots of investment going in as well. So, yeah, I think it is a really tricky agility is something that boards are going to have to grapple with, ever increasing, I think, going forward. And it brings up these perennial issues as you look forward as well in terms of, you know, mergers, growth. If you look to the Australian market, this isn't just something that's affecting the UK market, of course. This is a global phenomenon, right? So in Australia, you know, universities are a lot larger, and even there, looking at M&A activity in terms of mergers, it's a discussion that's ongoing in the UK. It's probably something that gets raised all the time in these sorts of conversations. But, you know, is there something that's going to have to happen going forward because of this pressure?
Andy, I guess, you know, sometimes there's, you know, kind of restructures of professional services. Sometimes there's, you know, taking out a layer of management in the faculty, school, department, you know, kind of structures. Sometimes there's actual course closures where programs are hard to recruit to. But actually, over in FE and schools, there's lots and lots of group structures now, kind of mergers or semi-mergers and so on. We've seen hardly any of that in HE in the UK. Is that, as Justine says, you know, this kind of mergers thing, is that where we're going to have to go, do you think?
Well, I think we're already going there. There are two or three sort of group structures already operating in HE that tend to include all of those sectors. So bits of schools, bits of further education. London South Bank is a very kind of high profile example. Coventry, Bucks New University. I think, you know, these are all kind of places that are going down those lines. And then you've also got kind of big college groups that are sort of expanding upwards into higher education. So Newcastle College Group and one or two others. So it's, you know, that's already happening. And I think for lots of institutions in particular parts of the country with particular types of sort of provision and specialism, I think more and more places will be looking at that kind of thing, as well as, and we can see this dotted around the sector news, as well as all those other things that you already mentioned, you know, closures, restructuring. I mean, it's quite interesting. I think, you know, the term we've commented lots of times in kind of sector conversations about the increasing turnover of vice chancellors, and there will be a wave of new vice chancellors kind of coming in at this period over the last 12 months, over the next 12 months, who will probably be asked these questions at interview about how they're going to approach this uncertainty and the kind of threats in particular markets. And I suspect the interview panels will be rather more interested in the answers to this than they might be answers to kind of where are you going to put us in the league tables. So it's tough, and I think kind of all of those options have to be on the table as institutions, either with new vice chancellors or kind of existing ones, start to write a strategy that's going to get them through the next 3 to 5 years.
Michael, risk is everywhere, and obviously there are big risks here for higher education providers, but I guess for students, you know, if I was an international student applying now, I wouldn't be sure if I will ever get on a graduate route. And actually, if I was just a kind of, you know, if I was an undergraduate at a university, I'd be worried that my departmental course might not exist, or at least not exist in the same way by the time I get perhaps to my third year. Plus, of course, a lot of the financial risk has been transferred to me now, because I've got to pay back my loan for 40 years rather than 30 years. But the transfer of risk to students can't be doing student decision making any good, can it?
No, definitely not. I mean, you know, the students paying more for less refrain is obviously something we've gone over many, many times. But, you know, I think just in the sort of international PGT sort of situation, there is clearly something to be said about, you know, how does uncertainty over the existence of the graduate route affect student decision making? Student decision making that's sort of happening right now for January, you know, and this will be being reported in the papers and for, you know, influencing students who are thinking of applying in September. You know, there's this sort of question about, you know, do students, can the sector recruit enough international students, given that this is the only real source of income where they can, you know, sort of cover costs. Can they recruit that without the graduate route or with hesitancy about the graduate route, you know, just on the terms of, you know, the quality of the education that's offered? You know, will international students still be looking at the sector and thinking, you know, a year of study here and then immediately returning home is still something that's really good for me, is going to advance my prospects, is going to make me learn, is going to turn me into a more rounded person, you know? And they will be having conversations with, you know, previous family members, friends who've done the same thing, and will be asking about the quality of the experience, you know, how much contact time they had, how many students were in a lecture, you know, who the lecturers were, how good the assessment was, all these kind of questions, which I think are sort of really straining and fraying at the moment. As you say, it's the same kind of uncertainty for undergraduates who are being, you know, for home undergraduates who are being told, you know, do an apprenticeship or, you know, think of other options. Maybe HE is a big ripoff. Maybe, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty in applicant minds for different kind of policy reasons, but you know, it all adds up to a difficult future for recruitment.
Yeah, and Justine, I guess, you know, whenever I read the FT, uncertainty equals lack of investment. And I guess that's true for individuals, it's true for businesses. This whole sense that the country's in chaos is not good news, is it?
No, and if you talk to any business organisation, certainty is the one thing that you want. You know, we work, many others do, universities do, on a 3 to 5 year planning cycle. You know, how do you manage that with this amount of change? You've got the impact, as you were talking, Michael, I was thinking, you know, the impact on staff at universities is going to be significant with some of these changes. The devil's in the detail, but that needs to be worked through. There's implications for businesses in terms of recruitment of talent because of these changes and where you focus. So, yeah, absolutely. You know, what people want to drive that economic growth, Andrew, is certainty. And that is in somewhat short supply at the moment.
Well, that's all very bleak. Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello, my name is Emily Nordman and I am a senior lecturer in psychology at the University of Glasgow. And along with my colleague Kiara Holland, who founded the University of Glasgow's Neurodiversity Network, but who has also currently lost her voice, we've written about our latest study on how students use lecture recordings, but particularly those students who are neurodivergent and or disabled. What we found very strongly is that in stark contrast to the usual concerns about lecture recordings and attendance, we found that the provision of recordings can actually help a diverse range of students maintain engagement by giving them just a little bit of flexibility to help deal with health problems, caring responsibilities, and of course the need to work through a cost of living and funding crisis. We also consider how the discourse on lecture recordings fits into the wider context of hybrid working and question whether some academics might want to take a look at their own working patterns before demanding that students attend every single session in person.
Now, next up, Justine, there's a bombshell delay to the ref.
Yes, indeed. I like the way you asked the non-academic person on the panel to talk about the ref. But taking it back to what I suppose we're talking about before, then, in terms of economic growth, what does the REF do, right? It drives research excellence. It provides accountability for public investment in research, which is what we want more of. And it informs the allocation of, you know, 2 billion or whatever of block funding. So it's right that this sort of consultation and thought process goes through. I guess the headline, as you alluded to, is it's not REF 28 anymore, but it's REF 29. The timetable has been pushed back. So instead of submission late 27, the submission will be in late December 28. There is ongoing consultation. So there's more to come in spring next year. Well, there'll be a summary report and further clarity on the timeline. In January, there's going to be more detail on open access requirements. And there's an ongoing review around the sort of people and culture and environment elements, including the weighting, I think. But the big headline is this delay. And the reasons given around, it's the preparation of using HESA data to determine the volume measures. It's breaking that link between staff and individual submissions and reworking the institutional codes of practice. So that is the certainty that has been put out in terms of the delay, but there are further consultations to come. But reading the release, you know, it's thoughtful. They've listened to the sector. There's been a lot of good submissions. And as they, given the importance of this, it's right that it is consulted on properly and reviewed.
Michael, I guess there's always a balance between getting it right, listening to the sector, as Justine says, and so on. And then, you know, a process which engenders and delivers further kind of uncertainty and delay.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Research England and the other funding bodies, as Justine said, have been taking a very, you know, consultative approach. They've been gathering feedback. They've been, you know, writing for Wonky about how they're listening to the sector. There's been various opportunities for feedback. Obviously, people and culture wasn't included the first time, so they opened a second consultation. You know, there's still the initial decisions really weren't at the level of detail which institutions need to say, okay, let's start planning. You know, they were quite broad strokes, and even the sort of, you know, new updates we've had yesterday, aside from the delay, there's still loads more work to be done. So that consultative process is obviously very nice, but it slows things down. And I think this is the sort of result of it, that, you know, people in the sector, in research offices, are just thinking, we have no idea exactly how we need to be planning for the next ref. And it doesn't even feel like it's very soon that we will know. And, you know, I think from what we've heard behind the scenes, there's been some, you know, quite strong words for the funding bodies that, you know, with this scale of change, of sort of, you know, sort of fiddling with the plumbing and introducing new data requirements and all this kind of stuff, that more time is needed, and it's been extended, which, you know, I think a full year makes sense. It's not a massive delay given the ref's sort of long cycle. And, you know, hopefully this will kind of settle some of the uncertainty and sort of angst about some of the other changes, and there's enough space now for proper conversations about what are quite complicated and technical issues that need sorting.
Andy, it's only a few weeks ago that Michelle Donnellan was kicking wokery out of science. Does this delay kind of minimise or maximise the chances of that people and culture stuff being caught up in, you know, some more of these culture wars stuff? You know, is this about which end of the party Michelle jumps towards as the election gets closer?
Well, let's just say that the chances of Michelle Donnellan being anywhere near the ref in 2029 are practically zero. So I don't think we need to worry about that very much. But I mean, you raise an interesting point, not least in the context of that uncertainty that we've been talking about in international figures and kind of domestic income and policy and all the rest of it. There's an amazing kind of dissonance that goes on in universities when you start talking about the ref. So entirely sensible, I'm sure, to delay it to 2029. You know, it's a big process. As Justine says, it hands out a lot of cash. You know, you got to do this properly. But 2029 is potentially two general elections away. not just one, two, and two spending reviews away. So, you know, there's a lot of assumptions in universities and in the kind of research community that this ref that is now going to run in 2028, 2029 is going to happen exactly as we think it's going to happen. So universities, you know, including my own, currently kind of thinking through how to prepare staff and kind of recruitment towards that ref. And it's given that sort of political uncertainty about whether people are going to be, whether the next government or the one after that, God knows how many science ministers that will be, are going to be interested in QR in the same way, whether they're going to spend this amount of money on research and development kind of across the board. You know, that's all up for grabs. Almost nobody would say with any certainty there's going to be a Department for Science and Technology that Michelle currently leads. So why are we so sure that everything about the ref's going to happen in exactly the way that we think it is, when everything else in higher education policy and politics generally says that policy churn is a problem? And I think the answer to that is that lots of universities like it. You know, we like the ref. We like it as a planning tool. We like it as a way of kind of recruiting and promoting people. But because we like it, we refuse to consider that it might be impacted by this huge short-termism that kind of pervades virtually everything else in public policy. So, you know, there's a big question for universities, for management teams, and for boards. You know, why do you think this ref in two general elections time, two spending reviews time, is going to work in exactly the way that we think it's going to today? And I would say I wouldn't be so sure.
And just before we move off this, Justine, there's something really important, I guess, that universities can do in terms of impact.
Yeah, I was just reflecting as Andy was talking there about, you know, it's that ultimate dissonance, isn't it, between the long-term nature of research and, as you say, this sort of reactive policy situation in which we find ourselves. But one of the things I think lots of institutions are focusing on is that impact point, is working with businesses and with a greater breadth of businesses. The NCUB State of the Relationship report came out this week, some really good case studies in there. We need more of them, right? And this isn't just, I suppose, my challenge out with of the sector, and for non-sector people listening to this podcast, I'm sure there are some who listen, this isn't just something that universities need to think about, something that business needs to think about. Some businesses are very good at reaching into universities and working with them, some aren't, and I think there's a big education piece for how businesses can work better with universities across research projects to drive that innovation and R&D that we know needs to happen to drive the economy, right? It's not just in universities, it's in partnerships as well.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And finally this week, a new report calls for more graduates and more education, Michael.
Yeah, so this is the lovely titled Ending Stagnation, A New Economic Strategy for Britain, which is from the Resolution Foundation, from LSE, and I think from either from or sponsored by the Nuffield Foundation. And this is really a massive, massive project with the idea that the UK doesn't have and does need an economic strategy is the sort of at the heart of it. The report, the sort of final report has appeared. And, you know, we had Jeremy Hunt and Keir Starmer were both speaking at the launch. There's been lots of other very readable and interesting little sort of sub-publications that have come out around, you know, there was one from David Willetts with his sort of greatest hits on how he would change HE if he was still in a minister. There's been lots about apprenticeships and the skills system. But yeah, this final report, as I said, is very focused on a sort of high-level national economic strategy, probably with an eye to Labour coming in and trying to sort of catch Keir Starmer's attention and others in his team. So it emphasises things like the role of the UK's second cities. It spends quite a lot of time talking about Manchester and Birmingham, saying that, you know, more growth is needed there, comparing the UK and, you know, the sort of disparity between London and the other large cities in the UK compared to other, say, European countries where it's, you know, just this enormous gulf in output and productivity doesn't exist. Yeah, and on graduates, as you said, it does suggest we need a lot more, but we need to think about where they are, and they need to be sort of powering the country's economy. We need to get them into the second cities and the cold spots and the places where they're currently not and where they're really needed for productivity growth. And then there's quite a lot of the sort of usual stuff about non-academic routes and, you know, fiddling around with the apprenticeships levy and that sort of thing. But, you know, the ideas, as you've written on the site, around sort of getting more graduates, but not in the sort of uncontrolled growth and, you know, just let everyone grab as many young people as they can, and so that FE suffers and you know, that the sector sort of just about hangs on. It's more about thinking strategically about, okay, how do we make more provision of all kinds of tertiary provision, and how do we do it in a way that's sort of planned, strategic, and, you know, dare I say, fulfills a sort of levelling up objective as well as a growth objective.
Now, Andy, at the risk of attracting the ire of people who will say that Birmingham is not in the north, it's not actually been very fashionable to talk about northern big cities for a long time, has it?
Hasn't it? It's not stopped me. I mean, I think economically what this report tells you is that everywhere's in the north, apart from London and the southeast, in at least in terms of economic performance. And, you know, that regional inequality is just, it just kind of shines out as a real problem of our economy, both in kind of productivity and sort of wages and in human capital terms, the gaps, the differences between the stock of human capital, however people have got their qualifications. And, you know, the UCAS data also this week shows just how different the progression rates are from most regions compared to London. So it's a great report, as you'd expect from the Resolution Foundation, you know, with David Willetts in the chair, Torsten Bell. You can see his hand, you can almost hear his voice in lots of this stuff, and it's well worth a read. I think you know, going back sort of really to the conversation about REF and even the conversation about immigration, you know, this is the thing that politicians most care about. Over the next 5 to 10 years, this is what's got to change, because everything else flows from it. Decisions about what universities do, how they're funded, whether you have a tertiary system, what you do with FE, what you do with apprenticeships, all of it kind of stems from how do you get growth and productivity going in the economy. And I would recommend everybody reads at least the first chapter, which is called Starting From Here. The you wouldn't want to
you wouldn't start from here.
Yeah, the you wouldn't want to bit is silent, but it comes out sort of loud and clear, if that's not a contradiction. And because it is an absolute horror story. Stagnating wages, firm performance, low investment on virtually every kind of crucial indicator, we are underperforming comparative countries in the OECD and in Europe. And it's getting worse. And so, you know, the need for the next government to do something long term and stick to it is getting kind of more and more important. And that's why, you know, the Starmer Labour mission of getting growth and productivity going is the one that we need to speak to. And, you know, Rishi Sunak's got a similar one. So it's not as if this isn't an agenda that's shared across kind of political parties, because it is. The city thing is quite interesting. I mean, Manchester and Birmingham get a lot of attention, as they did during the research phase of this. And there's I mean, there's a lot of very interesting stuff on what you could do across the tertiary space. Lots of stuff that would remind you of Augur, filling in that missing middle, the sub-degree provision and institutions and funding. Lots of kind of reminding us how badly FE has been funded and managed. But as you say, it's also saying, look, we just need more from Manchester and Birmingham, and that includes more graduates. I mean, hundreds of thousands of more graduates living and working in these kind of two second and third cities. And I'll leave readers, listeners, to decide, you know, which is second and which is third, because obviously that matters to people in Manchester and Birmingham. Manchester always say that kind of, you know, London's second, but, this report really doesn't quite bear that out. So, lots in there. I would make one criticism, which is that this is very supply side. It's very kind of treasury style, and it's thinking, you know, fix the supply side and stuff will change. And I think kind of we do need to think rather more about how the demand side works, not just in Manchester and Birmingham, but across the economy as a whole. What is it about the behaviours on the demand side, whether it's firms not investing, the particular structure of businesses that we've got, institutions that are kind of more interested with the demand side. I think to shift some of those problems, we need a bit more of an active government in that space. But overall, look, this is just brilliant work, and like I say, worth everybody's time to kind of read through and understand that anything that happens to universities in the future will happen as a kind of subset of the issues that are set out in this report.
Justine, I guess, you know, the debate that often comes up is this sense that, you know, you can either control student numbers and that will mean no expansion and a reduction in the number of students and, you know, Whitehall getting it wrong, or you can have a demand-led system where students can go and study whatever they want, wherever they want, and so on. And I guess there's something going on here that's neither of those, isn't there, which is about being more deliberate about what students study, where they study it, and then where they sort of exist for the first 3 or 4 years of their graduate life.
Yeah, and I'd written down when I was looking at this supply and demand as well, and matching those areas. And let's not forget, you know, there is still a massive inequity. I was looking at the UCAS numbers as well in terms of participation from a widening participation point of view. Let's not forget, you know, 50% of 18-year-olds in London go to university, less than 30% in the Northeast, right? So there is still a gap if we're going to drive this economic growth that the report talks about that needs to be addressed. And it's not an either or. I think it's very easy to get into this. Well, it's either a technical route or, you know, as Andy said, it's that 50% don't go, or let more than 50% don't go. We need to focus on that. Leeds is obviously the first city. I'll just put that out there as well. But there is a real importance around cities across the region, right? Devolution is part of the answer. So, you know, the trailblazing deal in Manchester, the integrated technical education system that they're looking at, the MBAC, you know, really important around this inclusive growth story. It's not just about growth or trickle-down economics. It's actually, you know, as this report says, you've got to address these inequalities. And giving people control in those cities is of really importance over education budgets and autonomy. And coming back to what we're talking about, certainty and having that certainty of funding, right, to think about these things. You're not going to shift the education system in a year or 2 years. This is a 10-year sort of program of change, isn't it, to get this education system, technical education system, match supply and demand. And, you know, to your point on businesses are changing rapidly. Their needs are changing rapidly. You know, KPMG, we're an accountancy business. We're also, you know, doing a lot of technical work, digital work. We need system architects. We need accountants. We, you know, there's a whole range of skills that we need in those cities that we've been talking about. So we need to step forward as well and work with institutions across the education spectrum, helping them inform the curriculum. Again, there's more to be done around partnerships and really active participation, I think, from business in shaping curriculum, not dictating what universities teach, but supporting and bringing real world experience and case studies, etc. I think that's much more can be done in that space.
Michael, I was reading the section on how to pay for it all, which was interesting. But the thing that I was reflecting on the most was all the way through the report, I was thinking, how many different Whitehall government departments would need to be in the same room and on the same page to make some of this work for some of these places? And that is a real problem, isn't it? Because, to some extent, to make this work, government is going to have to rewire and devolve.
Yeah, I mean, as Andy said, it does feel a lot like this is something for a future Labour Treasury to be thinking about. But there is, and Treasury is the big beast in the centre of government. But, as we are seeing with our current government at the moment, it's not the only thing. There's lots of moving parts. Labour will be in a very different, they'll potentially be, you think they're going to be a more united government, but all the signs are, at least to begin with. But they're going to have a Conservative opposition if they, assuming they win the next general election and are looking to implement these sort of, big supply side Treasury driven reforms that have all kinds of consequences around the immigration system, around, spending on different aspects of education, around things like the NHS workforce planning, and all these things are connected. They all have the potential to become sort of discrete attack lines from a future opposition that will be accusing them of, sort of doing something to support Manchester, say, which is, leading to, towns getting neglected, or is, there's all sorts of possibilities. And it does, at this time of sort of peak uncertainty, it does feel quite tough to see something like this happening. I mean, this title of ending stagnation, right, which is very much about the sort of economic stagnation. But all the way through, I just couldn't help feeling that it feels we're really suffering from a corresponding political stagnation, as a country. Not, I don't just mean the government here, that also needs to be sort of tackled about, can we think big about things? Can we do big changes? Can parties have the confidence to do things that they believe in, but they know will be an attack line against them? The signs are not great at the moment, but you can only hope.
Andy, when I was at a Labour Party conference this year, I kept moving from fringe to fringe, where I was going to fringe meetings that were of peripheral direct relevance to HE. So I was in a fringe about, the state of town centres, and then I was in a, and so on and so on. And what struck me most was, I don't want to be in any of these fringes. I just want to be in a fringe about Nottingham, or I just want to be in a fringe about Manchester. And so, and that, I mean, that is very, very difficult stuff, isn't it, to pull off?
It is. Were you lost? I mean, it was a big conference, wasn't it, this year? So, look, I think it is, but I think it's a really, really important challenge for universities. There are some things, if you moved around some of the bits of the fringe that I moved in this report, that Labour will be uncomfortable with. I mean, it says, for example, the next government will need to change the fiscal rules. It says that one of the ways to get devolution going is lots of fiscal devolution. And Labour don't seem very keen on either of those things at the moment, particularly not as they go into kind of campaign mode for a general election. They'll fall over themselves to say they're not going to break fiscal rules or change them from the kind of current Conservative model. But I think for universities, I think why that's crucial, and why town centres are crucial, and why Nottingham is crucial, why Manchester is crucial, why all of that regional underperformance is crucial. And this applies in London too. There's been a big kind of productivity slowdown in London. The implication is that if that continues to happen, then there's less opportunity to subsidise the poorer performing places, of which we have many. But the kind of existential strategic challenge for universities, I think, is this. It's that over the last 20 or 30 years, we've been very happy, all of us in universities, whether we're talking about graduates, undergraduates, or whether we're talking about R&D, to work on this kind of supply side model. We take the money and we produce this stuff and we chuck it at the market. And the assumption is that it will get deployed and utilized and everything will be great. What this report is saying is that we've done that and that hasn't shifted. So, if we want to be in those policy debates, States, if we want to get kind of more resource, if we want more of that long-termism, that instability, that kind of, you know, kind of less crazy sort of policy environment, what we need to do is to move from that supply side, look, everything's going to be fine if we just produce more of this stuff, to a really hard set of strategies and conversations about how do the things that we produce get deployed and used in the economy and the labour market, whether that's our graduates earning salaries or our local economies going from kind of also-rans in the OECD to something that sustains better jobs, better firm performance, better local economic conditions, and that then flows down to high streets and the quality of public services and all the rest of those things. And I think it's a crossroads for universities, because we either start to read these kind of reports and think, what can we do differently to change this? Or we stick our heads in the sand and say, all we've got to do is just keep doing what we've always done, producing more of this stuff. And all of those application utilization issues are somebody else's problem. They're not, they're ours.
So that's about it for this year. Remember, to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out how we can keep you and where you work ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the site and click subscriptions. So thanks very much to Justine, Andy, Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen. We'll be back early next year. Have a fantastic Christmas break. And until then, stay wonky.